Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, everybody. We've got an interesting one today, you know, for a change. William Crystal is my guest. William Crystal, the neocon, Al? Yes. And I'll tell you why. In some ways, to me, Bill Crystal has been one of the most interesting, prominent never-Trumpers. Most of the others who you see or hear or read were political operatives. You know, the Lincoln Project guys, Michael Steele. Bill Crystal comes from a much more academic, intellectual place. And I thought I'd try to get some sense of not just how he came to an anti-Trump stance, which is not, frankly, that hard to figure out, but how the establishment Republican Party's full embrace of Trump and Trumpism has made him rethink some of his own past beliefs. We recorded the conversation the day before the president's address before the joint session of Congress on Wednesday, which I thought was extraordinary, especially in its ambition. Basically, it's like Biden got his team together right after the inaugural parade. He just walked into the White House, got everybody in the Oval Office, and the president's behind his desk. And President Biden says, "You know what, everybody? Why don't we just do everything we've always known we should do, but haven't, and then do them?" And everyone says, "What a great idea, Mr. President." And the president says, "Ron," to Ron Klain, of course. And Klain says, "Well, of course, Mr. President, without much cooperation from the Trump people, we've been preparing for the unprecedented logistical challenge of vaccinating 320 million Americans." "Right, Ron. I'm up to date on that. I want you guys on that day and night." "Badisha, Mr. President, we've been working the COVID relief package, and get this, we're including a $3,000 child tax credit to reduce childhood poverty by half." "Excellent, Badisha." By the way, during the speech, President Biden noted that the $3,000 child tax credit would cut childhood poverty in half. There was a shot of the chamber. Not every Republican was on camera, but not one of them applauded that. Now, it's kind of a tradition. It's kind of something that you're supposed to do, is applaud something that's an unalloyed good, reducing childhood poverty by half. You kind of have to applaud that. I don't know. Reduce childhood poverty by half? Nah, don't like it. I'm a Republican. So the meeting in the Oval Office continues. "Mr. President, I've been working on the infrastructure package, and we think it would be a good idea to bring our country's infrastructure up to the level of other countries, other advanced countries, or surpass them and create millions of jobs for the very people who have been hurting, blue-collar folks who may not have a college degree. You think that would be a good idea?" "Absolutely, Liu Xuan. And that's exactly what we're going to do." "Great, sir. That'd be about $2 trillion. "Fine. We can't afford not to do it." "Thank you, sir. And we're going to make our energy grid as low carbon as possible to address the greatest existential threat to mankind, sir." "Great. Is anyone writing this down?"
No, Mr. President. Let me get a legal pad. Anybody got a legal pad or a pen? Huh?
"Mr. President, how about early childhood education?" "Of course, Tamika. A child who gets early childhood education is much, much more likely to graduate high school and go to college and get a good job and not go to prison or get pregnant in adolescence. That's just a huge priority." "I got the legal pad, Mr. President." "Good work, Emil. And as long as we're on education,
Let's make sure every kid goes to a good school, that the resources of your school doesn't just depend on property taxes. What a great idea, Mr. President. Yeah, yeah. So that every kid can go to a school that has a good physical plant and can pay for after school and great teachers. Great, Mr. President. I wrote that down, too. Keep writing them down, Emil. Mr. President, I have an idea. Why don't we make the most profitable corporations in the country pay taxes? Great idea, Corinne. It's Karen, sir. Also, it's not my idea, Mr. President. I've heard other people suggest that, you know, for years. Mr. President, as long as we're doing that, sir, since one of the problems is the huge gaps in wealth and income in this country, what if we made those at the top who can afford it pay more taxes? I like it, Tara. You mean like bring the marginal tax rate for people making over $400,000 back up to what they were at the beginning of the George W. Bush administration? Yes, sir, Mr. President. And we could hire back a lot of the IRS agents that Trump fired and have them audit very rich people instead of poor people like the IRS does now. Hey, slow down, everybody. I'm trying to get this down. Mr. President, we could also hire back the scientists at the EPA. In fact, why don't we just invest more in science and basic research? I don't like it, Siobhan. I love it. Like DARPA, sir, which gave us the internet. Good point, Latifah. Speaking of which, shouldn't every American have access to the internet? Broadband for everyone. That's great, Mr. President. Hey, I have another idea. I have one. Hey, I have one. How about making life a little easier for people? You know, by giving some family leave in case someone gets sick or something. You mean like every other developed country has, Tanui? Let's do it. Yay! You know what people care about, Mr. President? Healthcare. Oh, yeah. When Barack and I got the ACA done, it was a big fucking deal. Well, Mr. President, with all due respect, you should have said that to President Obama at the time. Actually, I did, Tamika. That was a joke, sir. Okay, everybody, I think this was a really good first session. These are all great ideas. No reason we shouldn't do all of them. So that was the first meeting of the team right after the inaugural. And basically, this president has just said, why don't we just do the things we've been saying we should do for years and years, and I applaud him. So, William Crystal will be with us right after this word from one of our commendable sponsors. We've got a great one today, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
My guest today is William Crystal. I can call him Bill Crystal because we were classmates at the University of Minnesota Duluth, where he played hockey and drank a lot of beer. He loved beer, but he was able to enroll in the political science PhD program at Harvard by pretending to be the son of Irving Crystal, the father of neoconservatism, and Gertrude Himmelfarb, the noted intellectual historian. How am I doing so far, Bill? Am I close?
Excellent, excellent. It's about 50% true and 50% okay. Not, good. Which is kind of what I expect, frankly, so that's good.
Yeah, that's what we pride ourselves in. I think, you know, most of my listeners know you and your career as a journalist, a member of the three last Republican administrations, publisher of the Weekly Standard, and a frequent talking head. Your head talks a lot. And as one of the early Republican anti-Trumpers to speak out against the former president. Now, we talked a couple weeks ago, right, about what subjects we should cover, and we decided on Biden's first 100 days. And I want to do that right out of the box because we're recording this on Tuesday, April 27th, which scientists tell us is the 98th day of the Biden presidency. So we're going to do that first. But after that, this is what I want to do. I want to ask you about your evolution over the last five or so years. And I'm not, it may be more, because so many of the prominent talking head anti-Trumpers are basically political types. The Lincoln Project guys were all campaign guys. Michael Steele's chair of the Republican Party. Charlie Sykes had a conservative political talk show. And I just want to hear about your journey.
So the only correction I'll bother making is I wasn't in either the W. Bush or the Trump administration. So it's actually been a long time. I left the White House. I was in the Reagan and first Bush administrations, and that's, God, it's hard to believe. It's almost
wait a minute. Did I say the last three?
Yeah.
I don't even count Trump as a
Republican. That's a good thing. So two of the last three pre-Trump. And speaking of journeys, can I ask you one thing? Do you remember this? I don't know. It's stuck in my mind. We were on a train together, D.C., New York, I think, typical kinds of trains people like us take, you know?
Right.
In the Acela. They're probably not first class. I think just the coach class, you know?
Of course not. Yes.
When was that, though? We chatted about Trump, and I was already sort of anti-Trump, and we were agreeing on that, but you were shrewd about that it was more dangerous and could be more lasting, and he could dominate things, at least on the Republican side, more than people expected. I can't remember if that was during the campaign or maybe that was 2017. Do you vaguely remember this, or you consign all these meetings with fans on trains to just the memory hole since you had so many of them?
I actually, well, thank you for, because I sound really smart there. So thanks for recalling that. Let's talk about the first 98 days, because this is the 98th day, April 27th, when we're recording this, and then it'll drop on the 102nd day. But go ahead. What do you think of Biden's performance?
Oh, good. I mean, impressive. And when you're too close to it, as I am, and, you know, here in Washington, watching, knowing some of the people and watching every little zig and zag, and I disagree with that, and I would have emphasized this, and I wish he hadn't had this line and things. But if you step back, I mean, if you had said 100 days ago that, you know, we'd have made the progress we made on vaccines, that the economy would be coming back, that the country would have calmed down, unclear, you know, on some of the political reform stuff, how much progress he'll be able to make, and whether and so I think he's done very well. I mean, the biggest disappointment since November 3rd has been the Republican Party, which has not at all liberated itself from Trump and Trumpism. In some ways, amazingly, has dug deeper or doubled down, you might almost say, after January 6th instead of the opposite. But the degree to which Biden is governing, in my view, is a kind of responsible Democrat, obviously to the left of me on a bunch of issues, but serious and sober and with a competent administration. I think it's been important.
I do worry about, you know, McConnell. I worry about
the Republicans. I mean, on the Recovery Act, American Recovery Act, not one in either house, not one Republican vote on something that like 65% of Americans favored. It reminded me of, 2009 and 2010 and 11 and 12, when they just did not want to help Obama at all. And, record number of filibusters and no cooperation. And we actually remember very early on, they did this sequester thing. We got to a point where they almost defaulted on the debt, right. and held a gun to basically to Obama's head and everybody's head and made us cut spending. They're still the same people. I mean, McConnell is going to I'm afraid he's going to keep doing this. Now, maybe on infrastructure, we'll come up with something. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it would be very good for the country for there to be something bipartisan that passes, whether it's infrastructure, or immigration, conceivably voting rights. That looks.
It's not going to be immigration, isn't
it? I don't know. It's a little bit on the border in return for DACA and some increase in the legal immigration quotas. Maybe not. But I don't think it has to be a majority of Republicans by any means. I just think it would be healthy for the country and, frankly, would help those of us trying to liberate the Republican Party a little bit, at least from Trump and Trumpism, to have 10 or 15 or 20 Republican votes for some of these bills. Now, having said that, the reason there aren't going to be those, or there may not be those votes, is, of course, that they're all intimidated and terrified by the Trump phenomenon. But look, I mean, the fact is that the 10 House Republicans and 7 Republican senators, much too small a number in my opinion, but who voted for impeachment and for conviction, it sort of made a difference. It had a dynamic of its own. Liz Cheney has kind of stayed the course on that. And again, she made many more accommodations than I would have over the preceding 4 years, but at least it reminds people that there is a possibility of being a pretty staunch ideological opponent without being hostile to American democracy and seeking to overturn election results. And it would be, so I'm hopeful. I'm a little, and I guess my contrarian streak thinks everyone else is saying there can't possibly be any bipartisan deal on anything. So maybe there can be on at least a few things, but.
Well, I think that on the George Floyd.
Yeah, policing is a good one. Yeah.
I think that's going to what I'm hearing is that there will be some compromise on that and that will happen.
So that would be, if you could get police reform, something through, and then people look, I mean, the one thing about compromise is people are allowed to come back 2 years later or a year later and try to get more. I mean, if people are unhappy on the left with some stuff that they have to give up to get Tim Scott and all that, I think it would be worth it. And it's, I mean, I feel this is asymmetric, as the Republicans have the bulk of the blame on this, but I do think actually it's in the country's interest for the Biden administration to bend over backwards, or be perceived at least, honestly, to be bending over backwards, to try to find one or two pieces of legislation, at least, where they can get some bipartisan support. I think it would help him politically, but I also think it would just help defuse things. And I mean, the degree to which Republicans, and not even Trump Republicans, just let's say established Republicans, have bought the line that this Biden administration is a bunch of woke lunatics who, desperately are seeking to shut down capitalism, take their guns, take their free speech, impose whatever the craziest thing that's happening in one private school on the Upper East Side of New York, impose that on the entire country. I mean, and I don't like some of these left-wing things that are happening in woke elite schools on the Upper East Side and so forth, but the idea, the degree of craziness in the Republican Party is really astounding. And it hasn't gotten better. That's, for me, one of the biggest stories of the last, 6 months or so. It hasn't gotten better, despite the fact that Trump is gone.
Yeah, it's frightening. They are afraid of their base, right? That's what it is. They're just afraid. I mean, they're afraid of Trump because they're afraid of his base. And this gets down to something I talk about all the time. My listeners hear me talk about it, which is the kind of two universes of information. Yeah. Information and disinformation. And boy, oh boy, I think a lot of maybe all of the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th actually believe the election was stolen.
No, I think it's a horrible disinformation echo chamber problem and all that, made worse by social media and all that. And then there's the thing that makes it really compounds the problem a lot, which is the elite Republicans who don't believe a lot of the stuff. They're not idiots. They know the election wasn't stolen. They know that Biden's not going to restrict you to one hamburger a week or whatever the latest insane Fox News thing was. But they want some of the Republican policies. And they're just willing to go along with that and indulge that. That's really the Mitch McConnell types, you might say. Kevin McCarthy, somewhat more craven version of the same thing. And those people.
Wait a minute. Whoa. Someone's more craven than McConnell?
Well, yeah, I know you have you served for them, so you know better. But well, McConnell did sort of did stand up against overturning the election, sort of belatedly, where sort McCarthy of voted of, to do so.
In a way.
So it's something.
Don't you do that right away? Don't you do
now,
that?
Now, believe like... me, I'm against. So I dislike all, and I disapprove of all of them. But there are some slight distinctions. But again, I think the conservative elites. I don't know. We're curious what we think about this. Everyone's so focused on the base, which is a terrible problem that 30% or something of America believes in totally ridiculous and insane conspiracies and so forth. But that the elites have gone along with it and tried to manipulate it to their own advantage and not stood up against it has been extremely damaging. The Wall Street Journal editorial page has not done as much damage as Fox News, but they've done a lot of damage. And mostly by going along with the damage that's being done by Fox News or rationalizing it or excusing it or minimizing it.
We'll be right back with Bill Kristol, who served in the Reagan administration and the George H.W. Bush administration, not in the W administration or, of course, the Trump administration. I got that wrong in the intro, and I'm ashamed. But we'll be right back, and I won't make any mistakes, I think, in the next part. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Okay, well, let's kind of wade in now then to you and your... I don't know how much of a transformation there's been for you in terms of in the last, how much is tied to Trump? I imagine a lot of it is. But, you know, as I said, a lot of these guys you see, the talking heads you see that are, you know, the Michael Steeles, the Steve Schmitz, the Rick Wilsons, they're campaign people. They're political people. You're an intellectual. You're someone who has a, you know, PhD in political science. You're a journalist. You write about this and have been a thought leader in conservative circles. How have you changed? And did it start with Trump or did it start earlier?
I think Trump provoked the reaction, which led to some rethinking. I mean, I think that's natural. You can't just have an event like Trump happen. I think it'd be hard to say, well, everything was great and this thing just came out of nowhere and I'm not going to rethink any of my previous positions when I see my previous allies going off in this, or at least if not allies, kind of people I, you know, vaguely on the same side of going off in this horrible direction. So I think you'd have to be pretty foolish, frankly, not to rethink some things. So I've tried to do some rethinking. And it's, I think I just got, like a lot of people, too dogmatic, too partisan. I thought of myself as being sort of contrarian and willing to take on Republican orthodoxies. And I think I did in some areas. And I, you know, supported things that the Obama administration did, especially in some of the first term and some of the foreign policy things. And certainly in Clinton's years, I did support many of their things. So I wasn't, I don't think, the worst of the, you know, kind of partisan types. But In retrospect, I think I didn't see certain things as clearly as I should have. I fought some things. I fought Bob Buchanan. I fought Ron Paul. I was clear-eyed, I think, about some of those aspects of the conservative movement, but I underestimated their strength and how much other people were willing to go along with them. So yes, the short answer, the long answer, short version of this long answer is I've done a fair amount of rethinking of my own past. I mean, I would say it's been easier for me maybe a little bit because Charlie Sykes and I, who you mentioned, who's very thoughtful and wrote a good book about this, actually, we both were Democrats when we were kids. I mean, literally kids, like in high school and stuff. I volunteered for Hubert Humphrey in 68. I worked for Scoop Jackson when I was at Harvard in 72. I mean, volunteered, beginning of my very successful political career. Scoop ran seventh, I think, in the Massachusetts primary that year behind Wilbur Mills. And I actually worked for Pat Moynihan in the 76 primary.
That's
in New
right.
York. So I was a kind of a Humphrey Moynihan, you know, Democrat, and then became a Reagan Republican, like many other people, by 1980. So I always had a little bit of a memory that, hey, there are decent Democrats. Pat Moynihan was a friend. You know, I mean, my parents had many friends of that sort. So I think that made it a little easier for me maybe to break, frankly, with the Republican Party and to say, look, I'm voting for Joe Biden. No ifs, ands, and buts about it. No big apologies or no big angst or anguish about voting for a Democrat. You know, so I think it maybe was a little easier for me, all I'm saying, is than someone who kind of really just grew up in the fold and had a tougher time breaking out.
Sure. And I think it isn't difficult if you're clear-eyed to go like, what the hell is Trump, and do what all of those guys I mentioned did. Stuart Stevens wrote a book. It was all a lie. I don't know if you read that or looked at it. Or
as Pat Moynihan, whom I mentioned, used to say, this is, I think, a line he once used to my mother. My mother would tell me he once used. They were pretty good friends, and Pat was a senator, a very busy man, and he started going on about some book that was like a 600-page biography of, I don't know, Yates or something. I'm making that up, but you know what I mean? Something that was not required reading as your senator. It was going on about it, very interesting, this and that. And my mom said to Pat, you've read that whole book. And Pat said, blah, blah, blah. I've read in it. So I've read in Stuart Stevens's book, which is a very wonderful, vague way of, you've read something between the jacket flap and the, whole chapter.
That was a pretty good Moynihan, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I knew him.
For a moment.
It's pretty easy to imitate, frankly.
Yeah, well, you don't hear many Moynihan impressions. You just don't. These days, especially.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, but Stuart was saying, you know, I'll give you an example of where I focused in on that, which is when W was running. He ran, I remember that first debate, and he said, by far the vast majority of my tax cuts go to those at the bottom. And they didn't. They just didn't. It wasn't even close, you know. And also, they supposedly, Republicans cared about deficits. I remember that. And I had this experience when I got in there where that's what Republicans seem to care about, with deficits. But they piled up huge deficits under Reagan, to a great extent under H.W., who did raise taxes a little, and that cost him his presidency, probably, to a great extent. And that's what got Buchanan, all that stuff.
Right.
But it seems like Republicans really care about deficits and the debt when there's a Democrat as president. Do you acknowledge that? I mean, it's obvious, right? Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's a certain amount of, someone had this put this point well in the Bulwark the other day. I just can't remember who it was, maybe Jonathan Last, my colleague, who's very sharp and a acerbic writer, that there's a big difference between, though, having a partisan interpretation of reality, a stressing of certain of certain facts at the expense of others, you know, kind of wishful thinking about your side, and just living in a totally different reality. You know what I mean? I really feel like that there's been some gradations along the way, but I think it's been a sort of a, there is a difference between putting a rosy picture of some economic policies or exaggerating the benefits to the working class of some tax cuts because of arguments about trickle down or whatever, on the one hand, and the kind of what we've seen under Trump. But having said that, look, I think there's been a fair amount of that on the Republican side, a little bit, obviously, on the Democratic side. I was a McCain supporter in 2000. That was such a bitter race that, you know, actually, for all that I was a hawk and supported a lot of the foreign policy stuff after 9/11, I was not on particularly good terms with the Bush team, maybe a little bit in the second term when things, you know, the McCain thing was already kind of been a long time ago. So, and I think the McCain thing, I'll say the one thing, supporting McCain, who I'd gotten to know in the 90s, really, because we were both hawkish on foreign policy. We both supported, ironically, Clinton on Bosnia and Kosovo and those kinds of things. That encounter with the kind of the pre-Trump Republican establishment was a bit of a wake-up call for me. You know, I was a young person in the first Bush and Reagan administrations. I looked up to these people. I didn't really know them well. You know, I just thought, well, they're pretty impressive. To see them up close in the you know, the Karl Rose of the world was not a particularly edifying sight of experience. So I think, again, I may have been a little more prepared for the kind of terrible disappointment in the Republican Party that I saw pretty close up in 2016. But okay. I'm still astonished. Aren't you? This gets back to our show. I want to ask you this question on the train conversation. I mean, aren't you a little – Trump as president would have been bad news, obviously, very bad for the country and so forth. But if Republicans had stood up to him in Congress, it would have been a much more manageable and containable problem. The enabling of Trump, the capitulation to Trump, the letting him and helping him take over the party, which we're now still seeing the effects of course, that I guess I didn't fully expect that. And that really is the cause of so much of the damage. It's one thing to have a bad president for 4 years, another thing to have one of the two major political parties basically off in conspiracy land and anti-democratic land and, you know, the whole thing, right? Fox News land. It's a little different, I think.
First of all, during that campaign, right, before he got the nomination,
right,
all my Republican colleagues were just aghast that this guy was doing well. And if you look at it, of course he did well because of, first of all the other candidates were terrible candidates, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They just were. And secondly, I think you've said this, like starting like 2014 or something, people started in the United States started saying, you know what, my kids aren't going to do better than I do.
Yeah. 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 Bill Galston, the guy at Brookings, who I've done some work with, says he could see it in the polls around 2013, 14. The comeback was happening a little bit, the recovery from 08, you know, and then it stalled out. It didn't stall out. It just was slow. And people sort of realized that if their kids hadn't had 4 years of college and, you know, maybe it had some problems, they might well not even make it to their standard of living. I don't know how widespread that is, really. If you look at the data, it's a little complicated. But I think that was a moment where there was a lot of unhappiness and anxiety to be exploited by someone like Trump. You know?
And I think that was. And I think also he exploited identity politics, yep, racial politics, people's feeling that anything that helps people of color takes away from me.
Yeah.
All of that. And I also remember like watching the South Carolina debate. And South Carolina, big military state, right? A lot of veterans there, mm-hmm, and bases. And he said like the war in Iraq was a mistake. And no Republican had ever said that, was running for president, had ever said something like that. And the crowd agreed. Mm-hmm. In this very conservative, very military state, he was tuned in a way that the others weren't, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you know? And also he had this gift of being able to get up in front of a crowd and riff for an hour in an entertaining way. Mm-hmm. I mean, entertaining in the sense of, you know, it, like watching a guy bite the head off a chicken is entertaining, but yeah, like, you know, but still, it, and you know, kind of funny in an odd way, whether you're laughing at him or with him, and they were laughing with him. And, you know, I still believe that I'm going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it was just something he said and the crowd went nuts and that became part of the thing, right?
I think more broadly, a friend of mine who had been involved, has passed away, who was involved in presidential campaigns, said he watched Trump and he thought Trump could win right from the beginning. Because Trump did what you have to do if you're to be a good candidate, is he really learned from the crowds and learned from what he tested a ton of things. The ones that didn't go anywhere, he just sort of quietly tossed aside. He was in that way a little more disciplined than people realize. And the stuff that took off, he just milked and milked and milked until it finally hit diminishing returns, if it ever did, with the immigration stuff, the Mexicans and the wall, the Muslim ban, you know. And he just was willing to, of course, say incredibly irresponsible and demagogic things that others weren't really willing to say. And he was clever. He was a good demagogue, right? He was clever at figuring out what would push people's buttons, and then he just kept pushing them.
As opposed to like Rubio or Jeb, you know.
I mean, Jeb, I give credit. Jeb earnestly believed what he believed and said it and probably knew he wasn't going to win pretty early and attacked Trump, actually, to his credit. Whereas Rubio was much more pathetic, I thought. I'm not sure if that was – I was a little surprised. I had a slightly higher opinion of him. But
yeah. He just – all I'm saying is they were running conventional campaigns in a year, you couldn't do that, or against a guy who is just completely separated himself from everybody and also took all the airtime because CNN would be, oh, he's speaking? Let's wait a minute. His plane is about to land. Let's go to it. You know what I mean?
Like, right. And you get a situation where people are kind of unhappy with the way things have been going. And the Republican frontrunner is named Bush, literally would have been the third unprecedented, the third member of the family to be president within, 30 years. And the Democratic frontrunner and nominee is named Clinton, the wife of the former president and former secretary of state under President Obama. So it was sort of like you couldn't have a better setup for a outsider, insurgent, you know, shake things up, drain the swamp. It was really, which is why I will say I was totally wrong about the primaries. I thought Trump would be just another, you know, Herman Cain, kind of Buchanan, troublemaker, outsider businessman, Steve Forbes, would fall short. The Republican Party had a pretty good track record at that point of nominating the Doles and the Bushes and the Romneys and the McCains. But anyway, he saw the opportunity. In the general, I always thought he had a chance to win. I mean, I remember saying this on TV many times and being on with some of Hillary's people who were intelligent political types, and they were very confident. And I was, I thought she would probably win. That's what the polls suggested. But I thought it was like a 1 in 4 chance that she wouldn't, that Trump would win, because there was such an outsider sentiment. And I just never underestimate that willingness to vote for change and to take a risk for change. And to discount the risks, foolishly, in fact, you know, in terms of like what damage the guy could do. I remember having so many arguments in 2016. I went to a Trump rally in Northern Virginia, and someone berated me. They knew I was anti-Trump. And I said, well, I think it's pretty dangerous. No, he's going to shake things up. And I made some sort of, you know, platitudinous comment. Well, if you shake things up too much, sometimes it's not like you don't have a good outcome, you know, the whole house falls down or whatever. And whatever the metaphor, no, it couldn't get worse, Bill. It couldn't get worse. You know,
couldn't get worse
than it is today. It's like, really? In America in 2016? I don't know, you know, but that was, people talked themselves into that.
Okay. But let's talk about just your, again, I want to get back to sort of, do you mind being called an intellectual, or is that the bad term?
No, I don't care.
Okay. You're not offended by it, at least.
No,
okay.
No,
so,
no.
But tell me just about what you've changed about. Like, for example, were you against the ACA when it happened?
Yes. I mean, I think I'm kind of standard conservative. We want a tax credit. It's not a bunch of government-run exchanges. I mean, I think that was I'd say I haven't changed much in foreign policy, where I remain a kind of unrepentant, into hawkish internationalist.
Well, let's talk. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay. I mean, I was wrong about some details, I would grant, but I think, and I actually somewhat
we're
happy
all
with the Biden administration.
Stuff.
Happy with the Biden administration so far on that. I was wrong on race to a considerable degree. I mean, I'm not wrong. I was a liberal civil rights person in the 60s and all that, obviously, in New York, and I wasn't, you know, a right winger exactly on race, but I just underestimated the problems of policing and of all the kind of the things that have been so visible in the last.
That's pre-cell phone.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is in a way. And also, I'm from New York. New York looked like it was falling apart and going down the tubes and had a pretty amazing comeback over about 20 years. And I was one of those who probably thought, yeah, Giuliani probably did a couple of things for the cops he shouldn't have done. But at the end of the day, it was in everyone's interest, including African-Americans and poor people, that the city got much safer, which isn't totally false, obviously. And so I think on those kinds of issues, I was just much too complacent, sort of in a kind of conventional center-right attitude. Economics, I've rethought some, but I'm pretty much a free market, free trade, liberal immigration person. But I mean, well, you know, income inequality is a problem, and there are ways to deal with that. A pretty conventional, you know, views on that, I guess, in terms of just make the tax code somewhat more progressive and all that.
Well, I'd like to hear that about that too. Okay,
that is to say, one reason I sort of like the Biden stuff is that a lot of what he's done is not, you know, try to run the country from Washington, big government programs, micromanaging. It's like, you know what? People need more money to help in this emergency and help bring up their kids and help their little small businesses keep going. So let's just give them some more money. In a way, it's a sort of, I won't say neoconservative, but, you know, it's more of a, it's not a big government, you know, expertise kind of activism as much as it is, you know, what if we have to run debts? We have to run debts, and we just need to help people make it through this period. And so I'm much more sympathetic to that.
Yeah, but we'll move to the next, that stuff that you maybe.
Yeah, so some of that stuff has to happen if you want to get serious about clean energy. Yeah. Even on like some clean energy, I'm pretty struck that a lot of it is pretty again, it gets a little more, intrusive, I guess you'd say. But a lot of it is incentives and kind of and stuff like that.
Carbon tax? Are you for?
Yes, we published like 30 articles in favor of a carbon tax in the Weekly Standard. But it was the kind of classic thing that liberal and conservative economists would agree on, that if you were going to get more tax revenue, that was a sensible way to do it. It's one of the things Biden doesn't have, ironically, right, in his proposal. It's kind of funny in a way.
I think that the most liberals for a carbon tax are for a revenue neutral carbon tax. Mm-hmm. So people are for it. You know what I mean? And right. That the money goes back to people who, because gasoline, the price of gasoline is like the most important thing to a lot of people.
Yeah. So there are ways to rebate that to lower and middle income people and stuff. And that's been part of the different kinds of proposals. And you could have an equivalent payroll tax cut. Anyway, whatever. Yeah, we're good on that. What else have I changed?
You're bad on race. You're a racist.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking. That was a joke. It was a joke.
I know.
Joke.
Yeah, these
days, I joke. I used to be in comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And what else, Chris? I mean, I think I just earnestly was too conservative with a little C. And I think, in a well-meaning way, if I could say, I mean, about a bunch of issues. Marriage would be an example. I mean, I just thought,
in a well-meaning way. Okay.
Well, I mean, thought it's like it's risky to experiment with institutions that are around all this time. I just didn't really appreciate. I haven't. And I'm happy we are where we are now on same-sex marriage and on a whole bunch of issues like that.
Well, but Clinton was for the Defense of Marriage Act.
Yeah, and Obama
he signed it. And Obama wasn't for it. It evolved. And don't feel too embarrassed about that.
So, incidentally, what is your sense of the Biden administration? You know more about it than I do. I mean, you actually know very senior Democrats quite well. So
here's my sense of it. Here's my sense of at least what's going on in the Senate and what's going on, and that's to do, of course, with getting this legislation done. I think it's really interesting what Manchin is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, first of all, Democrats, very liberal Democrats, very progressive Democrats, should thank God that Joe Manchin is in the Senate.
Yeah, yeah,
because Biden lost West Virginia by 40 points.
Yeah.
So the fact that Manchin is there is the reason we have the majority. So he has been kind of crafty, I think, on this. And he basically wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying, I'm against getting rid of the filibuster or weakening it. He didn't say modifying. He didn't say I'm against modifying. He just said I'm against weakening it. But he said, what I want to do is get back to regular order, basically is what he said. Mm-hmm. Which means you have hearings in committees, and then you write bills in committee, you pass them out of committee, they go to the floor, you have an open amendment process, right? Mm-hmm. We haven't really had that in a while. He wants to do that. We could do that if Republicans would cooperate, if they mm-hmm. would do that. And I have the feeling what he said in that op-ed was, but they better do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is a bit of a long game. I do think that on infrastructure, I hope that they can come to some accommodation. But again, I think it might be funding levels, and it might also be what this package. But what Buttigieg is talking about, what I hear, is that this is jobs, and mm-hmm. this is jobs for blue collar people. And boy, oh boy, as senator, you go around your state. And you get shown in every community the infrastructure project they want, right? And you go and you see that the railroad, the tracks, are between the town and the hospital. Mm-hmm. And that there's a oil train, that lasts 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So that an ambulance has to wait 20 minutes while this train passes. And all they want is an underpass, right?
Mm-hmm.
and there's millions of those. Let's do those.
Yeah.
And let's have, Americans want infrastructure that looks like the rest of the world, the rest of the developed world. What am I doing? I'm trying to make the case for an infrastructure, but that's ridiculous. What we're talking about is, can we get that done? And mm-hmm. I think that might be the one that goes to reconciliation, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the parliamentarian said, they have room for another reconciliation bill, which I don't know. I'm not a parliamentarian. So I think that's going to be it. probably. And that'll be good. People will like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't hold out a lot of hope for, I think McConnell is just wants to get the Senate back in the midterms and is going to do everything he can to do that. And I think in the past, what he's done is obstruct.
Yeah. I mean, we've never come out of a pandemic like this or had a post-Trump presidency. So maybe the kind of rules of the past don't quite hold in terms of the electoral implications of that. I don't know whether Biden can get how much credit he can get and how much, a Democratic Senate candidate in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin can run as a Biden Democrat and beat Ron Johnson or win 2 weeks seat. And that's a huge question. We just don't know at this stage, I think. I think it does depend who Democrats nominate, too, obviously.
Speaking of Sykes, he was like a Ron Johnson fan at one time, wasn't he?
He sort of, as he says and apologizes a lot, he sort of invented Ron Johnson. I mean, Johnson was this slightly obscure businessman who gave a speech, decided to run as an outsider. I think it was 2010, if I've got the math right. And
that's when he won
a good Republican year. And so he ran in the primary. And I don't know that he was favored at first or anything. And Charlie kind of was very taken with the speech that he gave and thought, well, this is a genuine outsider, a self-made businessman, kind of really speak for the country.
He wasn't a self-made businessman. Let me say something. You know, the two most important words he said in his business career, I do.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Is that true? Okay. Well,
yeah. His father-in-law, his wife's dad, is like this billionaire who has a plastics company. And he sets up his son and his son-in-law in this business where their only customer is the dad's and the father-in-law's plastics business.
Yeah, there's a little more of that among the self-made than one thinks at first, maybe. Though we have great examples in America still of that, obviously, but genuine.
No, they're really like Ross Perot was self-made, right?
Yeah.
He was a nut, but he was self-made, you know.
Well, a lot of the tech guys, I mean, originally, it's pretty impressive, but...
There are people who have done really impressive self-made things. You know who wasn't one of them? Ron Johnson.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. Yeah, you would know, you guys, Minnesota, Wisconsin, it's all one big,
He's not the brightest,
no.
May I say?
No. But I would not, I would expect him to be conventional and unimaginative and just kind of but to go crazy this way, I mean, that does tell you the power of a kind of, I mean, this is what's a little unnerving, not more than a little, what's unnerving about this moment. I mean, the power of a kind of, what a demagogue, lights the match and finds a lot of wood and then it just takes off and everyone else, a lot of other people jump on board for the ride, to mix metaphors, and the anxieties that can be stirred and the prejudices that can be awakened or reawakened or exaggerated, even heightened. It's pretty bad. And one thing that I find most unnerving is people like it. I mean, liberals thought these Trump people were sullen, bitter, angry types, and there's some truth to that, obviously. But they liked those rallies. They were kind of fun from their point of view. Now, they were fun partly by mocking disabled people and by, flaunting,
that's hilarious, by the
flaunting
way.
Their success over, as opposed to African-Americans and so forth. I mean, it's creepy.
Scaring the members of the press.
I think once people get used to that though, in politics, my point is that's, it's hard to get back away. It's hard to remind people you're not supposed to enjoy it. You're supposed to refrain from enjoying being a bully and part of a mob, but people like being parts of mobs, at least temporarily, I guess history suggests that. And it's satisfying in some visceral way. And that's what scares me the most about the current moment. I mean, the mob spirit is really alive in the Republican Party on the right. There's some of it on the left, obviously, too, the woke left. And so it's, a lot of having a healthy democracy is resisting the mob spirit.
Let's go to foreign policy. Let's talk first about Afghanistan. I think you were against that Biden's decision there.
I was. I mean, I didn't. I understand it, and I understand that people are awfully tired of it. And I don't think I didn't make a huge deal of it. I mean, but I think it's just imprudent if you can have 3,000 troops there and keep an adequate, if not good, you know, better than worst case situation, just stable without much in the way, frankly, of American casualties. And I think it would be worth just letting the status quo sit there for a while and continue to work on other things, but, you know, in the region and in the country. But I understand why Biden did it. I hate the rhetoric of, you know, we're never going to fight these forever wars. I just think you're going to have American willingness to do peacekeeping and occasional fighting, unfortunately, around the world and stick with our allies and have force projection and all that. So I am an old fashioned kind of, you know, internationalist of that type, I guess you'd say, still.
Well, you know, as senator, you go to funerals, right?
Yeah.
And you talk to families, and you want the families to be proud of the service, and they should be. They should be. But I talked to more than a few parents who, and spouses, et cetera, who were saying, what the hell are we doing there?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and same in Iraq. And I agree that, you know, a presence there, like a counterterrorism, I mean, this is going to be a disaster. Taliban's going to take over. It's going to be a disaster for women.
That would be bad, yeah.
But, you know, I've heard people say, like, well, we've been in South Korea since the end of the Korean War. Yeah, South Korea is an industrialized, I mean, it's a democracy. Right. It's doing great. Afghanistan is just not going to. That's not going to happen there. This is going to keep going on. And it'd be nice to have some kind of counterterrorism force where we don't have Al-Qaeda anymore, but ISIS can get in there. And
right.
So, and that's what happened by withdrawing from Iraq.
Right. I think there are ways. And I think the Biden people are talking a little bit about quietly about, well, that doesn't mean we don't have anyone there in terms of some CT, some counterterrorism and some covert operation. Who knows? You know, maybe they can keep the lid on without an explicit overt, you know, force presence of 3,000 or whatever we have. So
now let's talk about Cheney and Iraq and Rumsfeld.
So I mean, at the Weekly Standard, I mean, this is, of course, no one remembers any of this, so such inside baseball. We were very anti-Rumsfeld from the beginning. From before the war, we were worried there weren't enough. We were the McCain, which was, if you're going to do it, send enough troops, stabilize the situation, do a lot of civilian stuff. And so we were very critical, worried before the war that they thought they could just go in and out. We became strong critics by September of 2003 in Iraq. Rumsfeld banned me and others at the Weekly Standard from the Pentagon. He was so furious that I called for him to be fired in 2004. And of course, Bush kept him on for two more years, which is really disastrous because you could still have turned it around more, you know. You could have had the surge 2 years earlier, would have been a hell of a lot less deaths and a little more of a chance of keeping a kind of, you know, residual force and keeping it in a stable situation. So I was on one of those, I don't know if you ever went to those Munich security conferences that McCain used to take a delegation to, and I don't know, or Levitt or Lieberman, all those characters, and they'd invite some quote journalist types or foreign policy experts, you know, from previous administrations and so forth on the planes. So it was kind of fun to get to go on as one of these nice U.S., you know, Air Force planes that the senators get to use, and just a long weekend in Munich. So, it was 2003. I remember this right before the war. So it was like February of 2003. Sandy Berger, who had been Bill Clinton's national security advisor, was on the plane, whom I knew slightly. And he said, look, Hillary voted for the war, and I respect your advocacy for it. I think you mean well and all this, but he said, I just don't trust these guys to do it competently, especially Rumsfeld, I think. And I said, I'm very, very worried. And I said, yeah, but Commie, once they really go to war, they're not going to be irresponsible and not be serious about getting the right people and generals in there and not just trying to do it in the cheap and all this. And Berger said, nah, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. And, you know, we just left it at that. And there was no argument. We just left it at that. And it's really stuck in my, died a few years later, kind of young, but it's stuck in my mind because, I mean, it's unbelievable when you look at the way Rumsfeld ran the thing. He didn't find the right generals. He just let the people who were next in line run it. They had no guidance particularly. Then Bremer shows up and then they dismantle the army. And I mean, it's just.
Yeah, it was basically, you're fired. Saddam, right. You're fired. Now take your weapons with you.
God. No.
and by the way, we're just going to fire. Oh, man. We're going to fire all the people who know how the electricity works and the water works.
Right. And we're just going to have chaos, and we're not going to protect people. Oh, my God, that was so stupid. And Rumsfeld, yeah. Do you remember when the guys started protesting because they didn't have body armor and they weren't under-arming the Humvees and stuff?
The vehicles, yeah, yeah.
And that was like a couple years into the war, and he said something like, well, you go to war with the military you have, not with the military you want. And he said that longer after 9/11 than Iwo Jima was after Pearl Harbor. He was terrible.
Yeah, I remember Gates, one of the first things Gates did when he took over, and I guess it was the very, very beginning of 2007, was address that, actually. And they told him, well, it'll take us, sir, 24 months for the bidding and the procurement. And he said, screw that. I want this in the next, I don't know what it was, 60 days or something. And I think they did do it, actually. They up-armored these vehicles, I guess. So, yeah, no. Russell never had, for all of his macho talk about being a take charge, get it done guy, he actually didn't do that. And he sidelined people who could be critical. People like Petraeus, who had different theories about how to fight the war, were sort of sent off. Petraeus was at Leavenworth, right, in Kansas, in 2005, 2006, writing the manual on counterinsurgency. And so Rumsfeld, the disastrousness of Rumsfeld is not something, since the left tends to want to say they were all terrible and the right got to like Rumsfeld for reasons I can't quite remember, no one's really held him as accountable. Now, Bush has to be held accountable for having a kind of belief, I guess, in Rumsfeld. Maybe he's a little intimidated by him, honestly. I don't know. And Cheney defended Rumsfeld. So it was a very Powell sort of checked out. It was a terrible. I remember talking to the people like me who were hawks on the outside in 2003-04. We were just in despair because there was no one who was like being serious about running this thing.
Well, also, I mean, look, remember Cheney said, there's no doubt that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, well, that was right.
Okay, that was not true. And that was, and also he said that Atta met with, Iraqis in Prague, right? So a lot of it was based on, they were part of 9/11 and they weren't, and that they had weapons of mass destruction and they didn't. And so maybe we shouldn't have done that. Because, you keep Saddam there, they're a counter to Iran that we really weren't once we're in there. I mean, anyway, it's kind of was a disaster. I'm sorry.
It wasn't great. I mean, that's the only thing I'd say is by 2009 when President Obama took over, I mean, it was the weapons of mass destruction, intelligence failure is almost still amazing. Things weren't, it didn't destabilize the entire Middle East and all that kind of thing. I wish it had destabilized some of those places more. It just kind of left everything the way it was. And then there was the Arab Spring, where the real disaster was that it deterred us from being willing to do much because, it's just no one wanted to have another Iraq. So we didn't do anything with Syria. We didn't do anything in a lot of places. And we ended up.
Oh, we did something in Libya and that didn't.
Yeah, well, then so that great. We just did quickly and then did no follow up. So, I would argue that. The combination turned out to be pretty disastrous of, an incompetently fought war based on mistaken arguments, premises, and then the sort of reaction to that incompetently fought war and the withdrawal, which then led to ISIS and all. I think we still have opportunities to have a better Middle East, actually, in 5 or 10 or 20 years. And there's still some positive trends there, actually, despite it all. So maybe that would maybe
what,
that
what are the What are those exactly?
Well, I do think the Arab Spring remains, the sense that I think they did puncture, Bush punctured the notion that those people should just be happy to live under horrible dictatorships forever. It feels to me like there are more people in the Middle East, we may have hurt their chances in some ways, but who really want to fight against that. Now, how much we can effectually help them when you have this huge Saudi problem and stuff, I'm not minimizing any of it, but but of course now we have authoritarians in Russia and China and everywhere else on the offensive, so it's not a good. I mean, this is one thing I think people are underestimating. The Biden administration could end up being a pretty kind of major foreign policy challenges to deal with, 6 months, a year, 2 months, 2 years from now. It's not just a domestic policy thing with a couple of foreign policy side shows. I mean, people understandably are focused for now on the pandemic and and some of the domestic issues, you know, but it could be a little like FDR. People use the FDR comparison, but he was both domestic and foreign policy, right? So
he was kind of a pretty good president.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, when I know Tony Blinken, and when he was named Secretary of State, I just texted him and I said, well, I hope nothing really bad happens in the next 4 years.
Yeah.
And, oh boy. Well, I think we should wrap this up, but pleasure talking to you.
I enjoyed it. This was interesting. Some memories, pleasant memories, not so pleasant memories of Iraq, but now important to go back over and to try to think through, obviously. I mean, it is an interesting and unusual moment. I mean, it's not a great moment in American history with Trump and the after effects, but I don't know, maybe somehow, you know, these things can sometimes reverse faster than one thinks, right? Somehow we could have come out of this in a bit healthier in a few years, maybe. Is that possible? Or am I just kidding myself?
Well, again, I keep, my listeners know this, I keep emphasizing this disinformation universe that seems to expand.
That is a problem.
And, you know, I wrote that book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot, and other observations. And he was kind of the big bang. And it just seems like this with Fox and then the internet, and it's just expanding, you know?
Yeah.
And that's pernicious, I mean, and dangerous.
And having a party kind of just echoing it and amplifying it, you know? So it's not just.
Which is the scariest part, which is like, really, guys? Come on, you know?
Right.
Have you thought about maybe being responsible? Nah.
No.
Nah.
No.
You want to get reelected. I want to get reelected. I want to get. The only way I can not get reelected is if I lose the primary to a Republican to my right. So I'm going to be, I'm going to keep being a nut. I'm going to keep backing nutcase thing. Well, keep up the fight from your side, and I'll keep up the fight from my side, and we'll maybe, you know, meet there. And
I look forward to that, and good luck, and thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.